This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
Voila. I want to begin with a poem by Denise Levertov. She was an American poet who died in the late 90s. She's a hero of mine. She published this collection called The Stream and the Sapphire, and it chronicles her conversion to Christianity. The poems were written over decades, but she pieced them together to kind of trace the thread of her turning to Jesus. She converted at the age of 60. Which I think is kind of unique. But this is one of her poems in this collection. It's called Flickering Mind. Lord, not you. It is I who am absent. At first, belief was a joy I kept in secret, stealing alone into sacred places, a quick glance and away and back, circling. I have long since uttered your name, but now I elude your presence. I stop to think about you, and my mind at once, like a minnow, darts away, darts into the shadows, into gleams that fret unceasing over the rivers purling and passing. Not for one second will myself hold still, but wanders anywhere, everywhere it can turn. Not you, it is I who am absent. You are the stream, the fish, the light, the pulsing shadow, you the unchanging presence in whom all moves and changes. How can I focus my flickering, perceive at the fountain's heart the sapphire I know is there? This lecture is basically a response to that final question in this poem. How can I focus my flickering, perceive at the fountain's heart the sapphire I know is there? The generative power in that, generative energy in that question has been at work in me for some years, and I can say that my interest in the spiritual disciplines, my desire to practice them and teach more about them, is in large part due to that question at the end of that poem. So, how can we focus our flickering? Christians have long understood our need for help in this, our flickering tendencies, our need for structures, for habits, for liturgies, what Gertrude Mueller Nelson calls the rhythmic repetition that help keep us attuned to God, which is very similar to something Eric said the other night about us all being like instruments, continually going out of tune and needing to be retuned. The Christian faith, of course, grew within Judaism and the God-directed rhythmic repetitions therein, the God-directed details of daily life, of festivals, of rituals in worship, the very disciplines Jesus himself practiced. Now, right at this point, I think it's important to say, when I say disciplines, I do not mean punishment. I'm not talking about how Jesus punished himself. Discipline, first and foremost, means training. So I'm not talking about punishing your body or punishing your spirit when I use the word disciplines, but rather training, directing, guiding your body and your spirit towards God, towards the truth, the capital T. So I'm going to use words this evening like practices, training, disciplines, devotions. I'm going to use them interchangeably. And Jesus himself practiced this kind of training, these disciplines in the Jewish faith, training that included a weekly Sabbath, that likely included regular daily prayers, repeated festivals and pilgrimages. He practiced fasting. He sought solitude and silence habitually. He frequented the synagogue to hear the scriptures read aloud and taught. He was the pioneer of small groups, was he not? He was a faithful practitioner of celebration and of shared meals. And we know from the book of Acts and from early Christian documents as early as the first century that these Jewish practices were transformed in the early church into Jesus-centered practices, that is Christian, Christian practices. For example, the Lord's Supper or Communion or the Eucharist, all the different names we have for it. This was a transformation of the Passover meal, which was an annual celebration reenacting God's salvation. And now it's become a reenactment, still, of God's salvation in Christ. And I think it's interesting that we practice it much more than annually. Some of us even go to churches that celebrate the Eucharist every single time we gather. So that's one example. But also the weekly Sabbath practices of the Jewish faith became Sunday gatherings of hearing the scriptures taught, sharing a meal together, caring for each other, caring for the poor. Jewish habitual fasting was a very important practice in the early church and for centuries. It's sort of not as much a part of our regular life, especially in the Protestant world, but it was for a long, long time. And the daily and seasonal prayers of the Jewish people were at least in part, there's early documents that seem to say they were at least in part replaced by saying the Lord's Prayer. Three times a day, it was recommended, as early as the first century. So there were structures in place, Jewish liturgies, recurring activities, practices that then got infused by the revelation of Jesus and transformed with him now at the center. But practices remained. That's my point. Now, there's a lot that could be said about these practices, which came to be known as the spiritual disciplines. A lot could be said about what has happened from the early church until now in regard to the spiritual disciplines. It is a messy history, a polarized history, and it's not my point this evening to delve into how various parts of the church have used or abused the spiritual disciplines. Rather, I am thankful for a resurgence of interest in practicing our devotion to God in some more ancient ways and practicing our devotion to God with an emphasis on our whole selves. In the last 5 to 10 years, there has been a flurry of books on the spiritual disciplines, podcasts on the spiritual disciplines, retreats that you can go on. Even I use a daily planner that's based on the church calendar, as well as a regular practice of St. Ignatius's Examen, as well as the daily office. It's also part of it, which is an Anglican way of praying and reading the scriptures. And all of these resources in the last 5 to 10 years are centered on practicing a more embodied Christian spirituality, and they're built on helping people form habits of devotion. Habits of devotion. It's a wicked hat in here, hey? I was just trying to sound Bostonian. Wicked hat in here. It's all good? So all these resources are about habits of devotion. I grew up in a Protestant church, and sadly, I inherited the idea, and maybe the way of life, that said the Reformation was all about doing away with ritual and repetition and liturgies and disciplines. And it took me a long time to realize that the most non-liturgical churches, the most non-liturgical people still have liturgies. They're just newer. And I've also personally been really helped by Jamie Smith in this regard, in his book, You Are What You Love, the Spiritual Power of Habit, a book we often quote and recommend here. He describes the reformers like this, protesting not against liturgies, practices, and repetition in and of themselves, but naturalized versions of them. Naturalized versions. By that he means lacking the supernatural, only natural, like man-made versions of these things, godless versions, God removed from the practices. God had been dethroned as the primary agent in spiritual formation. And that is worth protesting against. Because God is where we must begin when we're discussing or considering or actually practicing the spiritual disciplines. Whether it's reading the Bible on a regular basis, or some kind of regular prayer, or gathering for worship on a weekly basis, those are kind of the three most common spiritual disciplines, or even fasting, going on a silent retreat, journaling before bed, or taking a prayer walk. Adele Calhoun calls these time-resilient ways of keeping company with Jesus. And they must be all about God. God as the primary actor in our spiritual disciplines. The spiritual disciplines are not about doing cool stuff, as the poet Sarah Chestnut recently put it. So what does that mean for them to be all about God? I'm going to offer some definitions, some theological backbone to the idea of practicing the spiritual disciplines, and then two postures that I think help us in approaching the spiritual disciplines. So first, a couple defining words. Number one, the spiritual disciplines are responsive. This is not just my first point for the sake of an outline or for the sake of organizing my thoughts into a lecture. I'm convinced that any faithful approach to the spiritual disciplines has to start here. In our practices, we are responding to God's initiative. We are answering his call. We love because he first loved us. We practice our loving devotion. We train ourselves with the spiritual disciplines because he first reaches out to us. They are responsive in nature. In Scott McKnight's book, simply titled Fasting, he describes the practice of fasting like this. Not as a tool to win brownie points with God. Not as a way to twist God's arm into doing what we want, like a hunger strike. But as a response to a sacred moment. I love that. And I think it applies beautifully to all of the spiritual disciplines. They are an appropriate response to the sacred presence of God in our lives, to his initiating love in our lives. They're not about conjuring something up or some kind of goods exchange, like, okay, God, I will fast twice a week. You make sure I never get cancer. Or I'm going to faithfully be an elder in my church, and therefore my kids must grow up to be faithful Christians. It's not a goods exchange. Neither are they about harsh treatment of the body, which Paul specifically warns against in Colossians 2, but rather they're about answering God's initiating, saving, redeeming love. The disciplines must rest in this or be rooted in this, that they are responsive. Otherwise, they quickly turn into something else. So we respond to God's love with not only a rational assent, but with our whole selves. And this is no doubt why the spiritual disciplines are kind of hip right now. There's a reaction against an over-rationalization of faith, or an over-rationalization of existence. like Jared, you mentioned the other night, that this speaks to the popularity of yoga amongst millennials. There is a strong desire to know and to practice with more than just our brains, but to know with our muscles, to know with our heart rate, to know through sweat beads on our skin. And the spiritual disciplines encourage this kind of knowing, this kind of training in knowledge, a creative, whole self involvement. Or, as Carol Smith and Eugene Mertz put it in a book that Dave and I have been reading together for years. Not because it's not a great book, it's just one you kind of come in and out of. It's so full of good questions. They put it like this. You can feel the responsive nature in here and also the whole self idea. Our lives are given to us, moment by moment, by a God who is gracious, faithful, and energetically creative in interacting with us. And we give our response to God, moment by moment, in the midst of the ordinary events of our lives. Later, they say, their book offers a daily, particular life response to God. I really love that. Responding with your lived moments, responding with your whole self, with your particular body. This kind of response might include things like kneeling, or dancing, or praying a breath prayer, which I think is something Shauna is practicing or has practiced. The idea of one single line of a prayer that has kind of a breathing out and a breathing in rhythm to it. It's a simple, single sentence prayer, easy to attach to your breath, which you're gonna do. Or this kind of whole body response might include a practice like walking a prayer labyrinth. Has anyone here ever done a prayer labyrinth? Yeah. They're not mazes, even though they might feel like it. They're like a guided walk through a path, often with hedges, or sometimes it's just marked out on the floor. The thing I have loved about them is that it feels like you're going to get lost, and then you end up in the center, which is such a whole self experience of what life feels like. In God's good grace, you end up in the center, and then from there, you go back into your life, hopefully with that grace alongside you. So walking a prayer labyrinth, or practices of abstinence, I think are another expression of this whole self, whole life response. Abstaining from things that affect our physical selves, things like sugar or alcohol. Abstaining from Netflix or Instagram. Paul even seems to suggest there would be a time to abstain from sex. These are whole self responses to God. And I'm not suggesting that they are anti-mind or don't involve your rational faculties, but to use a philistical phrase, they are about incarnating belief. With the spiritual disciplines, you are putting flesh and bones on what you claim you believe. Again, Scott McKnight talks about fasting like this, but I think you can apply it to all of the disciplines. He calls fasting the body talking what the spirit yearns, what the soul longs for, and what the mind knows to be true. The body talking what the spirit yearns, what the soul longs for, and what the mind knows to be true. You've probably heard the admonition to put your money where your mouth is. The spiritual disciplines encourage putting your body where your brain is, inviting your whole self into the redemptive work of art that God is making of your life. So that's number one. Spiritual disciplines are responsive. Number two, spiritual disciplines are a means of recalibration. See, they both start with R's. I like that kind of thing. Responsive recalibration. Hence the word discipline, training. I love how the disciplines are realistic in recognizing our tendency to get out of sync with God and with what life is really about, and therefore we need recalibration. Some classic devotional literature refers to the spiritual disciplines as the banks along a river, and the river is our desire. So we need these banks to guide and direct and recalibrate our desires. I think that's a beautiful picture. Practices repeated give shape and order to our recalibration. Whether we are conscious of it or not, whether we consider ourselves disciplined or not, it's very important to recognize that we are being calibrated. We are being shaped by what we do regularly and what we do on repeat. Jamie Smith, again, is so helpful here in his writing on secular liturgies. He calls liturgies tangible, visceral, repeated practices that carry a story. Such a good phrase. That carry a story about human flourishing that we learn in unconscious ways. This is what practices do. They carry a story that tell you this is what it means to flourish, whether we realize it or not. He says all practices are loaded with an orientation toward a particular vision of the good life. That's a phrase that's resonated with you, right, Vance? I remember you telling me something about that with Stephen Garber. Did he use that phrase? Yeah. They're loaded with an orientation toward a particular vision of the good life. So it's not a question of will you be shaped or calibrated, but how are you already being shaped by the tangible, visceral, repeated practices in your life? And maybe, upon examination, you'll want to change some of those repeated practices. One of the most frightening things I wrote down in my notes last week during Joshua's lecture on the pornifying of culture was this. I might not be quoting you, but this is what I wrote down. It's close to this. Whew. One of the most faithful practices in the world today is viewing porn. It's not that we lack discipline. It's not that we shy away from repetition. We are creatures of habit. But what we often practice is the wrong things, lesser things. We are trained to love all kinds of things other than God and neighbor. And the spiritual disciplines can recalibrate us. And one safeguard, I think, with the spiritual disciplines is that they should always serve the two greatest commandments. Love for God and love for a neighbor as yourself. Note the appropriate love of self there. This is what we need to be recalibrated towards. The spiritual disciplines have a telos, an end, an orientation towards which they recalibrate us. So, if you begin to meet with a spiritual director on a regular basis, or if you practice hospitality once a month, or if you begin to keep the Sabbath holy in some new ways, or maybe you volunteer at a community garden that serves the poor, or you send money on a monthly basis to your church or to some kind of organization, these are disciplines that draw you back. This is their purpose, to recalibrate our hearts, our bank accounts, our desires, our schedules, to recalibrate them toward love for God and love for a neighbor. The reality is exactly how Levertov said it. We are like minnows darting away, darting into the shadows. We are prone to wander. And so we need this recalibration over and over and over again. And recalibration towards particularly loving God and loving neighbor. This recalibration we're after, it is, I have good news. It's what we were made for. We were made for relationship with God, and not just the moment of conversion, not just that sinner's prayer or that altar call, but a relationship cultivated over a lifetime and indeed on into eternity. We know and affirm and experience the fact that human relationships can only be cultivated over time and through repeated interaction. And so how much more with God? In The Spirit of the Disciplines by Dallas Willard, he writes this: wanting relationship with God without effort is spiritual romanticism. And later in the book, he says, there is no such thing as sudden Christ-likeness. There's no such thing. It takes time and practice to be transformed into the image of Christ through your own unique self, your own particular story. And this long-term cultivation in relationship with God is an invitation to what Michael Casey says, one of my favorite writers on prayer. He says it's an invitation to a lifetime of saying yes to God. Which also reminded me of Joshua's lecture last week, your description of virtue as being less about these isolated acts and more about becoming a certain kind of person. This is what the spiritual disciplines make possible, placing your whole self before God as a response and as a means of recalibration. Okay, I've talked a lot about what they are or why they are. Now I want to move into how to practice them and be very practical. I'm going to offer two postures, two ways of carrying yourself into the disciplines. I like the word postures because it's a body word. It makes you think of how you hold your whole self. So two postures for carrying yourself into the practice of the disciplines. I hope these might even introduce some creativity into your devotional life. First, posture. As you approach the disciplines, whether they're new or old, take on the posture of a student. The disciples, who likely knew how to pray full well as practicing Jews, asked Jesus to teach them how to pray. And so we can approach Jesus in the same way. You could pick a gospel, Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John, those are the four gospels, and study how and when Jesus prayed, how he practiced solitude by withdrawing, look into when he fasted, study his amazing practice of asking questions, or his regular night walking. Approach Jesus like a disciple, which is the root word of discipline, as a trainee, and ask him to teach you. This posture as a student is embodied in Mary and Martha, the sisters. Mary sitting at Jesus' feet. She had lots of other things to do, but she took on the posture of a student, sat at his feet to learn from him. We can also become students of Christians through the centuries who practiced devotion in a variety of ways. I'm not suggesting all of those were wise. But the rich devotional literature of the Church Universal is an amazing opportunity to learn how Benedict prayed, how Brother Lawrence ran errands, how Julian listened to God's voice, how Luther confessed, how Bethmore studies scriptures, how Edith Schaefer set the table for visitors. Become a student of those who have walked with God and disciplined themselves in the ordinary details of their lives. And let's not forget the Christians right around you, especially those who are older than us. Let us become their students. It might even encourage them in their practice of devotion. These women and men we can ask them about their repeated practices, how they incarnate belief, and try some of their disciplines for ourselves. This is why I really like the word practices. You can sense in it the posture of a student, an apprentice. And this approach helps us resist the temptation to try and control our lives, especially to try and control our spiritual lives. As a recovering perfectionist, this has been an essential posture for me in my devotional life, in my spiritual disciplines. Susan Phillips is the executive director at New College Berkeley, and she runs a center for spiritual direction there. And she writes this, in regard to our practices and in regard to that desire to try and control the outcome of our practices. She says, we sometimes receive, we cannot manufacture. In our spiritual disciplines, we sometimes receive, but we cannot manufacture. You might have an amazing prayer time one day, but you can't manufacture that to keep happening day after day after day. When we place ourselves before God in regular, repeated ways, we're not somehow guaranteed that He will then respond in the way we are hoping. The spiritual disciplines are not reins on God like a horse. They are instead reins on us. A way of life that recognizes I have much to learn. I come as a student. We come wanting to learn more about what God is up to in our stories, not trying to be God's teacher in how things should go. And this is a real temptation. The longer you've maybe practiced a particular spiritual discipline, we're tempted to say to God, okay, I've been very faithful, God. So where is your faithfulness? And this is a good place for a warning, I think. If and when you notice this attitude creeping into any particular discipline, it could be wise to stop that practice and try another. That spiritual discipline has likely become an idol, an instrument to get something from God, rather than a humble response to His initiating love. I don't think there's any easy blanket statement to say, here's when you should stop a particular discipline. That takes wisdom. It takes people who know you well, who are around you, and can help you discern what God is doing in your life. But for the perfectionists here, to move on from a practice is not necessarily failure. It might actually be growth. So that's the first posture, the posture of a student. Second, and you know, I was realizing in the last couple days, these two postures really kind of mirror the two definitions. I might just be saying the same thing a slightly different way, but still think it's helpful. Second posture, the posture of a pilgrim. See how this mirrors recalibration? It implies movement. And the posture of a student kind of mirrors the responsive nature, not being in charge. Posture of a pilgrim. The early name for Christianity was the Way. This communicates the dynamic reality of following Jesus. We are on the way, not yet arrived. The posture of a pilgrim anticipates movement. A pilgrim is going somewhere, and you can therefore start where you are as a pilgrim, with just one foot in front of the other. If the first posture was embodied in Mary, the second one is embodied by the two walking the road to Emmaus, talking with Jesus. He was opening the scriptures to them. He had some very harsh words for them. I think he called them fools at one point. In my work at Labrie, I find people often interested in spiritual disciplines, but bogged down by guilt. And my advice is to quickly confess. If there is real guilt because of laziness or disinterestedness or rebellion, confess that. God is faithful to forgive. We could even say it's one of His most faithful practices to forgive us. But to waste time and energy wallowing in what your devotional life is not is a tactic of the devil. Instead, start where you are. Consider yourself a student. Consider yourself a pilgrim. And start moving. Michael Casey, who I've mentioned a couple times, he's a Cistercian monk in an abbey near Melbourne, Australia. He gives good advice here in his advice on prayer. He says, better to start with a little and upgrade ever so slowly than to begin boldly and find it impossible to maintain one's pace. The life of prayer is more a marathon than a sprint. And I think Dallas Willard at one point says something similar too. He says, occasional joggers don't sign up for a marathon. Is that right, Daniel? You're the runner. occasional joggers don't sign up for a marathon. So it's likely that if you came tonight, you are not altogether satisfied with your devotional life. Unless you're here at Liberty and you just had to come tonight. But it's likely that you're not altogether satisfied with your spiritual disciplines, your devotional practices. Here's some of the greatest advice I've heard if you're in that place. And it comes from Susan Phillips, who wrote a book called The Cultivated Life, which I would highly recommend. This is her advice. We're going to actually follow her advice together for the next little while. She says to begin considering some things you already do regularly. And if you really sit down and do this, it is crazy surprising how liturgical you already are, how much you do repetitively. Here are some obvious ones. Sleeping and waking. This is something you've been doing faithfully from the womb. Or eating 3 times a day. It's likely that you have also been doing that for a very long time. Or driving or biking or walking somewhere at least maybe 5 times a week to school or to work. Those are the more obvious ones. But then, if you really start thinking about it, you start realizing the other repetitive things you do, your other practices. Let me give you a few of them. Showering. Shaving. Your face or your legs, depends on who you are. Brushing your teeth. Brushing your hair. Putting on makeup. Using the toilet. Exercising. Checking text messages. Checking a weather app. Preparing meals, cleaning up after meals, cleaning a variety of other things, making something in a workshop, knitting, checking email, taking out the trash, scrolling through photos, applying essential oils to your neck. That was for Shauna. Filling your car with fuel, walking your dog, replaying conversations in your mind, maybe especially ones you wish had gone differently. If you're married, something you hopefully do regularly, making love. If you have children, also something hopefully you do regularly, disciplining your children or reading them a story. Or Facebook scrolling, or reading tweets, or watching the news. This list could go on and on and on. There are, in fact, many practices already in all of our lives. And I gave you this long list because this is Susan Phillips' advice. Choose 1 or 2 activities that you already do faithfully and connect a spiritual discipline to them. It's an easy, simple way to approach the disciplines as a pilgrim, beginning where you are, connecting a discipline to something you already do on a regular basis. It's like grafting, you know, the horticultural endeavor, where you take a smaller, weaker, different branch and bind it to a stronger trunk or a stronger branch that has good roots. And then over time, the weaker, smaller one can get stronger and also mature. That's the idea. This is what praying before meals essentially is. It's attaching the practice of thanking God to something we do regularly. It becomes a habit, hopefully, of saying thanks, of pausing to recognize the givenness of things. Or many people pray with their children before bed. Again, you go to bed each day. It's an easy place to attach a discipline. These practices can then become a part of your rhythm, the pace at which you go and pause and go and pause. I'm curious if any other practices came to mind besides my long list. Does anyone want to shout one out? Things you do regularly?
Writing a Bible verse on the bathroom mirror and brushing your teeth.
There you go. There's a discipline attached to brushing your teeth. What about just other things you do regularly that have nothing to do with spiritual disciplines yet?
Watching TV.
Yeah, watching TV. Getting dressed. There you go. Folding laundry.
Exercise.
Yep. Exercise.
Drinking coffee.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one. What's that?
So that's spiritual.
What did you say, Sarah?
I said grocery shopping.
Yeah. It wasn't. That's good. Grocery shopping. Or unpacking groceries, even. That feels like I'm always
doing it.
Cleaning the refrigerator. There you go.
Having allergy shots.
Having allergy shots. Yep.
Going to the mailbox.
Going to the mailbox.
Stoking the stove.
Yeah.
Reading in the summer.
Yep. Yep. Seasonal. What's that?
Paying bills.
Paying bills.
Yes. But whenever I was doing like wood off the start, you know, it's kind of like, I'm just kind of doing wood. But like now, it's either like I'm like halfway and kind of like praying the whole time, mm-hmm. or I have like one of the gospels like audio book the whole time. But I'm kind of like just kind of having like an open kind of conversation with God. Like it never kind of stops. Like I'll never kind of like amen. Like I get to this certain part. Just kind of like there'll be like sometimes 2 or 3 minutes of silence, and then sometimes I'll kind of say something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, but like it's become just like a spiritual practice, like you could say, like, I guess like I know whenever I'm about to do wood, it's like I'm about to like, you know, hear some gospel, and then like kind of like a good like prayer time that like sets my day, just keeps me where I'm at.
Yeah, so good, exactly. So let me give you a few examples of how you might, you've already heard some, and maybe you even have some stirring inside of you, how you might attach a spiritual discipline to something you already do regularly. When I was giving this talk somewhere else, I heard, or someone brought up the idea of brushing your teeth. You mentioned something attaching to that. But we talked in that setting about, like, okay, every time you brush your teeth, you pray that the plaque on your heart would be breaking up and falling away. And that just becomes something you pray when you're brushing your teeth. Or I heard about a guy who knew the number of speed bumps, I was telling Dave, between his house and his work. And so he began saying, okay, between the first speed bump and the second speed bump, I'm going to pray for my wife. Between the second speed bump and the third speed bump, I'm going to pray for my kids. Between the third and the fourth, I'm going to pray for my colleagues. It's like speed bumps as rosary. It's really cool. Or something, actually Dave recently recommended this to me. I have a cell phone and I don't like it, but I have to use it sometimes. So I made my password a particular word. I'm not going to tell you what it is because you could get in my phone. But every time I have to get on my phone, I'm putting something in my phone that helps me remember who my father is and who I am. Or cooking. This is something I'd love to do more of. As I'm touching the ingredients that have come from this earth, you know, being mindful during that time to pray for the activists, the farmers, the politicians who are making all kinds of decisions about the future of this amazing earth. I don't do that. It's just an idea that I'd like to do. Do you have other ideas? Yeah.
I had a friend that every time she would shower, which was every day, she would remember her baptism.
Oh my goodness, yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah.
Who's it saying? You should say grace every time you fill your tank with gas.
Oh, yeah. There you go. So good.
Making my bed every morning, I kind of drew this from Tish Warren Harris' book, but bringing an order to earth into bringing a small order to life.
There you go, yeah. Mirroring, or acting like your creator. Order from chaos, yes.
Paying bills and taxes.
Mm-hmm.
I try to thank God that I have the money to pay the bills and the taxes. That I have a place to live and I can
there you go.
To be thankful, you know, rather than resent them.
Yeah. Rather than gripe the whole time, yep. Any others come to mind? Yes.
Praying about the upcoming work day on the way into work,
yeah,
then I usually know who I'm working with, so praying for that individual, my relationship with them.
Mm-hmm.
What God might be doing.
So good. Yeah. Thank you all for sharing. I'm not trying to suggest, by the way, that you should see how many spiritual disciplines you can do. Can you fill every single moment with a spiritual discipline? But rather, just to give you a lot of ideas so that you could explore and find ones that help you to respond to God, to recalibrate, and to flourish in the life that you've been given. Lastly, I just want to say a couple more things. If you undertake to begin or refresh a spiritual discipline, I'm just warning you. You will need some tenacity. Resistance will meet you immediately, in my experience. Our enemy is prowling around, looking for someone to devour. And so as soon as you set your mind, I'll give you some examples. Say you realize you're not someone who, or rather you don't rest very well. And so you start thinking, how can I practice Sabbath in some new ways, in some healthier ways? It's likely that the time you set aside as your Sabbath, whether it's Sunday or Tuesday or an evening or whatever, will be full of emergencies suddenly, seeming emergencies. Or I've told some of you this and then a few weeks ago, I've started taking a walk with a question of Jesus. Jesus asked many questions, amazing questions. They're powerful, generative questions. And so I have to walk our dog a lot, and so I will take one question of Jesus with me on a walk and just try and meditate on it, try to really hear it, and even try to respond to it in some way. But I cannot tell you how many times right before my walk with the question of Jesus, I have some kind of tiff with Dave, some kind of little fight. And so I'm tempted the whole time to just like be stewing, like he doesn't understand what my day has been like, what my personality needs, and just kind of like on and on and on. I'm so tempted to do anything but the discipline I have decided to give myself to. The seemingly urgent will threaten to swallow your resolve to live more intentionally. So you've been warned, or rather encouraged. I don't know. I want to just end with a few words from Susan Phillips. This is her encouragement with regard to the disciplines. It's a little wordy, but it's so wonderful. I'll read it slowly. Enjoy the gift of participating in your becoming. Enjoy the gift of participating in your becoming by directing desire into discipline. May it be so. That's all I have. Just hoping we could have some question and answer time. Question and discussion time. Yes?
Can I just tell a funny story of
discipline
being sidetracked?
Yes.
I actually told the students this a couple weeks ago, but I'll just share it again. About a year ago, I did a lecture here on Sabbath, primarily because I had no practice of Sabbath in my life, and it's something I really wanted to explore. And a couple weeks after that, I had a Sunday. Sundays are quite busy at Liberty, and I actually had a Sunday where I didn't have to do a meal, and I was like, I am going to have Sabbath. This is going to be so great. And it is hard for me to settle down and do that. And so I sat down at my kitchen table. I had like tea and my Bible and a journal. And I sat there for about 3 minutes, and I share a wall with Ben and Nikayla's six-year-old son, Noah. His bedroom, there's a door that divides our
room. It's best to help you.
Yeah, and this, and I've lived next door to Noah for six of his 6.5 years of life. This has never happened before.
Except that day.
And this music, like so loud, I could make out every word. It was so loud, and it was the sound, somewhat annoying soundtrack to a movie, a kid's movie, and
it was a Lego Batman, wasn't it?
A Lego Batman movie.
It was big.
That soundtrack.
And it. Like, I was like, if you sometimes play music, I was like, this is, and it was so loud that I was actually worried about his ears. Like, I was like, if he's in, if I can hear this as well. And so I went downstairs, and I think I've been in it. He was like, I'm sorry. This is too loud. And Noah came downstairs, and then hollered at him, and he came downstairs, and he said, ha, 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 I turned it up all the way, and I pointed it right at your door. He never does that.
He could tell you were about to have a moment.
Yeah, it was just one of these moments. I was like,
he was like, I hear God drawing me.
This is finally my day to like practice this thing that I was lectured on. And Noah, anyway, so that was just an example. And it has not happened.
Sidetrack.
It had never happened before, and it has not happened since.
Case in point. There you go.
We normally have a very good neighborly relationship.
I know.
I want to throw him under the bus.
Yes, Margaret.
Here's just another example. Dick and I started many years ago praying every morning, usually trying to pray before we get up, just pray right together then. And one of the things we prayed for every day for years was that God would give our three sons wonderful wives. And he did. And they met their spouses in all different ways and places, and not all in Christian settings at all. But we just felt very thankful. We're very thankful for that.
Mm-hmm. We'll tell Michaela you said that. Yes, Eric.
I was going to ask about a specific practice or discipline of fasting. I wonder if you've looked at all in the Old Testament, since it gets frequently attached to repentance,
mm-hmm.
or we, I think, tend to think about it a lot in terms of maybe controlling appetites or desires or whatever,
mm-hmm.
maybe hoping to improve some mastery over bodily desires or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't, have you looked into that at all in terms of its close association with facilitating repentance,
mm-hmm.
Sort of creating discomfort for sin? Or
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. It's definitely linked to repentance an awful lot in the Old Testament. I think there seems to be room for it also being a practice of saying no to certain appetites in order to strengthen other appetites. But yeah, I think Scott McKnight would amen that it's largely about responding to, often there, it was a response to their own sin. Yeah, it was a way of responding to the sacred moment, as we're saying. I think Josh was going to be talking more about fasting too on Monday, right? Do you have anything you want to add to that?
I think to start, like one of the things that was very confusing for me about fasting and still is often it's presented as like its primary thing is like you suppress your body to elevate your spirit, which has to be some part of it to some extent, but that easily becomes body versus spirit,
mm-hmm.
which is not a biblical or Christian or Jewish way to think about the body. And so I think you're talking about like whole person response, like you bring your whole person before God, body and soul, and say, I have done wrong, I want to turn. And so McKnight calls it, he goes through different reasons why people fast, and he calls repentance like your body turning. So
yeah.
What you're doing physically with your body by not eating is also sort of, it's representing what's going on in your spirit, and you're doing it together as opposed to sort of suppressing one to strengthen the other, which makes sense, I think, in a sort of biblical anthropology or Christian Jewish anthropology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was just curious, your own experience or maybe in your readings, differences that you found in spiritual disciplines individually versus those done in community with others, and maybe how those are similar, or ways that you grow and learn, similarly, maybe how that doing that with other people.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Richard Foster in the Celebration of Discipline even has like a separation between corporate disciplines and individual or personal disciplines. But you're interested in how they come together, or?
Yeah, maybe how they come together. And
yeah.
Maybe just in the rhythm of life.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd say we need both. That there we are both persons and persons in community. And as part of the body of Christ, we need to practice our devotion to God collectively. That doesn't need to. I don't think that should replace our personal practice. As far as how they go together, I don't think they should replace, and yet I remember a dear friend at one time talking about, it was a horrific story. I don't need to go into all the details, but they were fostering a little girl in a big city who was murdered. And just randomly, it didn't have anything to do with her. It was just kind of this terrible, horrific circumstance. And this woman was telling us the story. She's a really faithful, amazing, devoted woman. And felt like she went through a season where she could not personally reach out to God in any way. But she could take herself to her local church gathering, to her family there, and they could carry her in the collective practices, of singing, of praying, of receiving the word, listening to the word, and letting it do its work inside of them together. And she felt like she could be held there and enter them again slowly over time, but not personally for a little while. And I've often thought, what a beautiful example of being carried and held by the communal practices when you can't do them on your own.
I think I've seen that also with someone very, very seriously ill, maybe terminally ill.
Yes.
Frustrated inability to pray.
Yeah.
And to be carried.
Yeah. Yeah. And to be aware of maybe a time when you might need to be part of doing the carrying for another person. Yes, Isaiah.
How do you feel about, maybe this occurred to a couple other people, but tying the chore of dieting with the spiritual discipline of fasting, whether that's a tacky thing to do?
That's a very good question. Whether it's tacky or not, we could discuss. But I definitely think they are not the same thing. And to try and spiritualize your dieting, I don't think it would be a good idea to call that fasting. Scott McKnight makes the case that fasting is about abstaining from all food for a short period of time. Any other practices of abstinence, like maybe curbing the way you eat, he thinks we shouldn't call that fasting. People have different views on this. They say, I'm fasting from television, or I'm fasting from beer, or whatever. But historically, fasting is about no food for a short period of time, rarely ever more than 24 hours. So I wouldn't call those the same thing. And I don't know if it's tacky or not. Other people can comment on that if they want. Yes.
I would say that I think that for people who have eating disorders, fasting can be a complicated practice. And I think people are in different places, but I think it is often recommended that someone with an eating disorder actually not fast from food.
Yeah.
Because things get tangled.
Absolutely.
And it's hard. And I think there, I connected to the dieting question. I think there are people who maybe don't have an eating disorder, but have disordered eating in a way that might also be the same for them. So
yeah.
I don't think there's a black and white kind of line to draw on that, but
yeah,
it's worth thinking about.
Maybe. Yeah. That's good.
If you're just trying to give up sugar or
increase
your calorie intake or something, that's a
different thing. Yeah, just do that. Don't say that necessarily doing it for God. Yes.
Yeah, I think, I guess related to that, but on the other side, I think that there is
place for reorienting perspective towards food that says, like, this body is really important, mm-hmm. and how I treat it is important. Mm-hmm. And so, obviously, dieting, you know, at least in our culture, is primarily a means of increasing sex appeal.
Yeah.
But if the perspective can be reoriented such that it's, you know, I am promoting the health of this physical body that I have, which is good, which God created me, and which I'm here to steward,
yeah.
Then it seems like there's a, it's not fasting exactly, but yeah. there's a place of a kind of spiritual practice of eating well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. There could be a spiritual discipline of abstaining from foods that you know are detrimental to your body and are, yeah, changing your body in ways that you don't want. That's a good point.
Mm-hmm. Do you have ideas for how certain practices maybe go along with the rhythm of the church calendar? I was just thinking Lent and more abstinent practices.
Yeah.
Are there other thoughts of how there's kind of a, maybe different rhythms to different practices?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, man. I love these. There are definitely all kinds of amazing practices for the church year. One really fun and simple one is just to pay attention to the colors of the church year that have long been believed to be a part of the season. You know that the colors you see affect you and are a part of what's going on in your life, in your whole life. So obviously we do that at Advent to a degree. I mean, it's become kind of green and red. I think the liturgical color is actually purple during Advent. So you could, you know, have a little more purple in your life during Advent, or have a little more green in your life during ordinary time. That's kind of a simple one, but one that matters to me because I love color and shape. Some other really refreshing and nice ideas I've heard recently. So Epiphany tends to be a season we don't make a big deal of, at least in most Protestant churches. It includes celebrating or recognizing like the wise men, the Magi, coming and realizing that's their epiphany, who he is. And I heard someone suggest that during that season, some only count it as a day, but most people count it as a season. During Epiphany, write letters or send messages to people who have been a part of the various epiphanies in your life and thank them for being a part of the epiphanies you have personally experienced. That's something I've wanted to do for 2 years. I haven't done it during Epiphany. I keep writing down to do it, but I haven't done it. And yeah, in ordinary time, I really love to live into this huge span of time each year that basically tells you year after year, most of your life is lived in this very ordinary way, in this kind of regular, it's not crazy huge feasts or, you know, black and dark fasts. It's green. It's full of life. You're growing, hopefully. So I especially like to be involved with green things during the season of ordinary time, which is particularly easy to do because it's when things are growing in most climates. Yeah, and during Lent, I think ways of kind of joining the Israelites, but also joining Jesus in the wilderness. There's a lot of different ways one might do that during Lent. I just kind of keep those phrases in mind, like, okay, this is a wilderness time. How can I make room for the reality of wilderness times in my life during these 40 days? Maybe someone had an idea. Yeah, Marty.
This wasn't related to that. Anyone wants to respond with wilderness times, but I've often thought of the Jewish festivals in the Old Testament and just how embodied they are and thought, I wonder if there's in Christian communities that, or even if there are Jewish communities that practice things like living in tents with your kids for,
you know,
remembering the Exodus.
The booths, yeah.
And eating unleavened bread and because there wasn't time for the bread to rise and just remembering the Exodus and just thinking that how what an amazing experience it would be for kids growing up not just having Sunday school classes but actually doing that as families and as communities living in tents to remember for, and does anyone know?
We knew a lady who built a very strange and large treehouse to live in during the Festival of Booths, and she was a Christian, but she was just enamored by Jewish festivals and wanted to kind of have more of a whole self experience of the salvation story. So it included the Festival of Booths. Yes.
Can you talk a little bit more about how in our spiritual disciplines we can, you mentioned sometimes we receive what we cannot manufacture in your lecture. So how do we practice these spiritual disciplines in a way that does not feel like we're just trying to create experiences for ourselves?
That's a good question. We will probably sometimes do that. Just try to create experiences in our lives. But that was part of my hope with the idea of these postures, keeping this way of being in mind, that you're a student, you're not the teacher, you know, that you're a pilgrim, you're on your way, which means you're not going to do it perfectly all the time. You're practicing something over and over again, just giggling from previous conversations. I don't know that we can even perfectly control whether or not we will ever do that with the spiritual disciplines. I think there are safeguards, like the idea of these postures. That's exactly why I was offering them, as a way to say, here are some ways that can help us approach them in a way that's not, trying to twist God's arm or just trying to manufacture a certain heightened spiritual experience. Right after she said that thing about you sometimes receive, you cannot manufacture, she said something about, like, we have no control over how robust our experience will be with God. It's kind of like, are you sure? But it's a good word. I think it's true. So. Yes.
Even just making that part of your prayer life.
Yeah.
You know, asking God, show me when I'm just trying to manufacture something. No, he's very interested in helping us do that.
Yeah.
Over time, not necessarily even in the moment. But
yeah.
It's important.
Yeah.
Because, we'd like to light our own fires, I think.
Yeah.
In prayer and spiritual life.
And there are warning signs like this, that frustration I mentioned of, like, okay, God, I'm doing all these faithful things. Why aren't you doing all these faithful things, like giving me an amazing experience in prayer or while I'm fasting or while I'm sitting here in silence? Some of those warnings are when you start kind of, God, you need to keep your end of the bargain. You realize, oh, it's not a bargain. It's a response to grace. Yeah.
Just a thought with that. C.S. Lewis has a little book on prayer called Letters to Malcolm. And one of the things he says that was helpful for me was, he said, there's no prayer that God won't answer, but if there is, like, a leading candidate, it's encore, like, do it again. And then he quotes from Solomon, the family, when God came to the temple, and said, the heavens and the highest heavens can't contain you, so, you know, how can this building, and then Lewis says something to the effect of, you know, if God is eternal and exists outside of time, that means all of human history isn't enough space for him to sort of present himself once. Like, it's just contain who he is. And that just that, like, not praying encore has been...
Wow.
It comes in the back of my mind, because I have a few significant experiences with God in my life where I'm like, I would like that again. And then I'm realizing I'm not actually asking God for him.
Yeah.
I'm asking him for that.
And, yeah.
I just find that I can sort of pray that prayer in so many different ways. Mm-hmm. I don't know, that's sort of a correcting
kind of
voice in my head.
Yeah, and like the disciplines or prayer never as an end in itself.
Yeah.
But always, part of movement towards God himself. Yeah.
I just thought something that was very helpful that I didn't realize, it hadn't really occurred to me in this light before, was the Susan Phillips' suggestion that you attach discipline onto something, to a liturgy that you're already doing.
Mm-hmm.
That to me sounds hopeful as a way of, because I love that image of you're attaching a weaker discipline onto a stronger one.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the one that you do without thinking because it's so habitually mm-hmm. established in your life, or so physically necessary, like sleep or eating. It had never really occurred to me that maybe the reason why the discipline of saying grace before eating is connected, because you're always going to eat, and it's almost like we have to figure out some way to actually pray. So do it before you eat.
Yeah.
You're always going to be eating. And
so, we know you're going to eat. So.
But it's obviously an appropriate time to give thanks for the thing itself that you're going to be doing and for God sustaining you. But I love that. Ways to do that, things that I'm doing anyway, you can connect.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a way of I think protecting those liturgies from becoming idolatrous in their own little ways, because you'll be framing it in the context of thanksgiving to God for what that thing is.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that was very helpful. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome. Yeah, Marty.
A number of years ago, I participated in a stress reduction clinic,
mm-hmm.
Started by John Kabat-Zinn, who's a Buddhist and a physician,
okay.
Sort of the marriage of
East and West
medicine and
mm-hmm.
Eastern meditation. And I actually did a lecture later after I had time to read his books on just looking at the Christian faith, biblical teaching. In light of that, and where is there overlap and where is there not overlap.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that was helpful to me, which I was able to bring very biblical Christian meaning to, is the practice of being present
mm-hmm.
in the present moment. It's one of the things about thinking about your breath, because
mm-hmm.
you can't store up breaths. You breathe, you have to breathe all the time, and drawing some attention to your breath. But they have this practice, things like when you're that being present, I am here and it is now.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're brushing your teeth, or when you're doing anything,
mm-hmm.
just because we're so apt to
mm-hmm.
to be preoccupied, our minds preoccupied with the past, with regrets, with worries about the future,
mm-hmm.
but actually bringing ourselves to the present, which actually Jesus told us to do. He said, worrying about the future doesn't do any good.
That's right.
Don't add a day to your life.
Won't add an inch to your stature.
You know, science now takes days off our life. taking something like that phrase, I am here and it is now, which my family would actually repeat to me over and over again when I was going to this course, because I was so bad at that. But and then just saying, I am here and it is now, and I'm a child of God by grace. Just a phrase like
mm-hmm,
that
mm-hmm.
while doing things.
Yeah.
Like brushing your teeth or whatever.
Yeah.
I found really helpful.
Yeah.
I continue to find that helpful.
That is helpful.
Be in the present.
And if anyone's interested to just kind of look up a variety of disciplines and how to do them, and really good, practical, lovely advice, this book here is Spiritual Disciplines Handbook, the author of which I think a lot of you know personally, but this is a great resource if you want to look up. All of these are good resources.
Wow.
If you're interested, this is just for yeah, you can peruse if you'd like. Yeah, Sarah?
I was just thinking back to Liz's question and that comment from Susan Phillips about sometimes procedurally cannot manufacture. I've been trying to just recall like occasions in my own life where I have unexpectedly received what I would describe as like both like this sense of power and tenderness of God, and they have come because of conviction of sin, and or because of like realizing like, oh, I'm in deep need of healing. there's hurt and brokenness inside me. Maybe not sin, but a space that I think God wants to do something with. And so I don't know if I'm thinking of the same sort of experience as she is, but it does occur to me that, you know, we sometimes receive, we cannot manufacture, but we can push away, especially because I think so often when it comes to areas of our own need, we're investing tons of energy in pushing that away, and pushing away our need. So, I don't know, I kind of think it could even be a preliminary practice to, like, let your need come close. And, you know, to acknowledge, I am here, and, like, this is what I need, and, or what I don't have, or how I am hurting. And, I think it's been in occasions like that when I've actually let that kind of acknowledgement and awareness surface that I have felt or experienced a fairly palpable sense of God's care.
Yeah. In that. That's good. Thank you.
I was thinking also connecting to this question that, like, the habits and the liturgies that we already have that we talked about, like showering or brushing our teeth, like, I mean, I know it's a different thing, but, you know, I don't have any expectation that brushing, any one time of brushing my teeth is going to be the
powerful right? encounter
or never the know. Shower or folding the laundry, but there's something about, I really loved, I can't remember if this was you or somebody else, but the idea of this river being like desire and the spiritual disciplines being the banks of the river. And I just think of like how over time, thousands and thousands and thousands of years, a bank shapes a river also shapes the bank, right?
Yeah.
But just this idea that I have like zero expectation when I go in to brush my teeth, except that by brushing my teeth faithfully twice a day, I will be able to keep these teeth for a long time, and it makes me a healthier person over time, and it adds to the quality of my life. That over, I don't feel that gain in any one brushing of my teeth, but there is, but the repetition and the practice of it over time, you know, taking a shower is no great shakes, but it's part of care for hygiene in my body, and if I don't do that, things start to fall apart, right? And so I think there is a sense where, I know it's not apples to apples here, but there's something where just, like, to Jared's point of the making the bed, or that, I mean, there is just something that those things do shape us by the repetitive nature of them over time, even if we're not aware of it or conscious at any one moment, or even over some span of time. I don't think I'll appreciate the practice of brushing my teeth regularly until I'm 70 or 80. Right.
And you're like, look what that is.
Exactly. Right. You're still there. Yeah.
Marty. Right. I didn't mean to suggest people in their 70s speak like that, by the way. Not what I was saying. Yes.
Actually, following from Mary Frances said, I've actually started, I guess partly just because of the news of all these places with droughts and that taking the shower, well, I consciously thank God for water. I consciously thank God for hot water and try to conserve it. But I think the practice of giving thanks is huge. And it's interesting in Romans 1 how the beginning of total rebellion against God is they refuse to give thanks.
That's right.
And so the practice of giving thanks in as many occasions as we can.
There you go.
Do that. And it just, again, you know, the last few years, water has been one of those things that I've, that has just struck me. I need to thank God for this water. Chance to take a shower for water to drink, clean water to drink.
So good.
well, this is a little bit different track, but do you find prayers of other people particularly helpful? And if so, who's, where, why? Because sometimes this can be a great sort of support and carrying and carrying us to places where we sort of don't have those resources in ourselves, and yet this prayer can really connect what we feel. Do you have any thoughts of people's collections of prayers or anything like that?
I'm a big fan of other people's prayers. Not because I don't want to articulate my own personal words to God, but I often can't or don't know how to. I can't quite say that which is in me. And so, yeah, Cranmer, is that his name? Wrote the Book of Common Prayer. His prayers have probably been the most shaping in my personal spiritual formation. I just found an articulation there beyond my own personal ability in the moment. And that's super life-giving. Also, Walter Brueggemann's collections of prayers are astounding. I mean, they're like, they're poems, really beautifully fashioned poems.
His books, what is that?
He has a book called Prayers for a Privileged People. And another one called something about heaven, or what the other one's called? I don't know.
Are those his own prayers or collections of other people?
They are his own prayers, and they are prayers that he prayed before class that other people wrote down and had published because they were so incredible. His have been powerful.
Yeah, they're like modern psalms.
Yeah, yeah. Really stunning. And there's maybe three collections or something. There's a lot. I can't remember the names of the other two. This book is by Phyllis Tickle. I mentioned her. It's called The Divine Hours. And they're prayers specifically for autumn and winter time. I have loved those prayers. We have a lot of collections of prayers, actually, that we've found meaningful, helpful. And also to surround our kids with all kinds of prayers, not just the ones that I can come up with or Dave can come up with, but, you know, the faithful throughout history and the ways they've approached God. I feel like that's such a rich stream to kind of dive into and enjoy the company they're in. What are some names of some other ones? Yes, of course, his are mostly sonnets, but many of them are prayers directed toward God. They're only 14 lines long. They're kind of short and sweet.
Who is this?
Malcolm Gite. He's a professor at Cambridge, and he's a priest in the Anglican Church in England. G-U-I-T-E. Yeah, he has a book called Sounding the Seasons. Another one's called The Singing Bowl. Another one is Parables and Paradox. All of those have been very important to me as well, and in our family.
The Puritan prayer book comes to
mind. Yeah, the Valley of Vision, right? Yep, those are beautiful prayers as well.
The hymn book.
Yeah.
The hymn book,
yeah. Yep. Yeah, you were even mentioning that, meditating on a particular hymn. Good. Do other people have prayer collections that have been helpful in their own lives, in your own lives?
The Psalms.
Yeah?
Psalms.
Yes. Yeah.
There's that poem by John Donne, which I can't remember if it's prayer. I think it's a prayer, but it reminded me so much of the poem that you read at the beginning. It's about how easily we're distracted from prayer.
You know,
I'm sure you're...
I don't know. One of his holy sonnets, maybe?
You remember what it's called? It's so great.
He just complains about the buzzing of a fly, the creaking of a carriage going in the street outside. anything will distract me from
prayer. Yes, I think I have read that.
When I finally realize I've been distracted, I don't realize how long I've been distracted. And when I quit talking to God and when I've just been spinning off of my... It's just so totally human.
Yeah.
I totally relate.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that's a prayer or a
reflection. I can't remember if it's a prayer or just a...
Yeah.
confession.
Reflection on prayer, on the distraction. That reminded me of, I love the poem you read in the beginning.
Marie Howe is a poet who lives in England. She's a current poet. She has a great poem called Prayer that's kind of like that. It's like a descent into her like packing list and her need to go to the pharmacy. And then she's like, and even now I'm just planning to get up out of my chair. And that's like the end of it, of her prayer. So that's really well done. It's just called Prayer if you want to look that up.
Some of Mary Oliver's poems feel like prayers to me.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Even her, you know, I don't know what a prayer is, but I know how to pay attention. And the summer day. Yep. Yes.
Going along with a hymn book inspiring me to pray or being like a model. A long time ago, somebody encouraged me to reflect on the lyrics of whatever song was being sung in group singing.
Okay.
And use that as an opportunity to pray to God about how that might relate to you and how that might be relevant to you.
Mm.
And that's been a real encouragement to me to just sort of, I mean, it doesn't distract anybody else, you know, when you pause from singing along with everybody or even continue singing. And just keep, or start praying in that moment to God.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I'm glad somebody suggested that for me.
Yeah.
Pass down.
Good, thank you. Well, thank you all. I think we can wrap it up there. It's only like 9:35, but thank you.